Kreisky-Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
Welcome everybody to yet another conversation in out of Kreisky's Wohnzimmer. I'm very glad that you have joined us, and we are all aware that in everybody's mind, first and foremost, we are dealing now with two spectacular crises. The one is the crisis in Ukraine, the vicious attack of Russia on an independent country. The second one is the consequences of the terrorist attack by groups from Hamas on Israel, and the consequences that have escalated over the last couple of weeks, and that are in the impact and the consequences also on public opinion. Very, very difficult to deal with. Today we won't talk primarily about the conflict as such, but rather about the consequences that arise from this conflagration. Consequences on the American political system, on the political situation, on the various constraints that are put on the administration, but also the consequences for Europe, and as such, on the consequences of for the transatlantic relations. I'm delighted that we have two renowned guests for this conversation, and I'm very happy to welcome Ellen Leibson and Henri Barquet, both of them extremely knowledgeable about affairs of the Middle East. Mrs. Leibson is a former president of a well-known Washingtonian think tank, the Simpson Center. Henri Barquet is university professor at Lehigh University, but also a specialist for Middle East affairs at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Let me start out with a first question to both of you. We all know about the deep commitment of the United States to the State of Israel as such. The commitment for continued political, financial, military support, a support that has always been unconditional and on which Israel could rely. And nevertheless, I have now, and perhaps I'm mistaken, but it's my perception or my feeling, that in many things that come out now of Washington, there's always a little but, yeah? What you hear is certainly Israel has the right of self-determination, of self-defense, but is the measure really commensurate? Does it really respond to the crisis? Israel has certainly a right to fight against terrorism, but not every Palestinian is a terrorist, and there are so many factions and other things that are to be considered. Military action is inevitable, but is the destruction and the takeover of Gaza really in line with the task under international law, that you have to protect civilian lives and that you have to minimize destruction? So these are things, and one asks oneself, and this is the question that I would like to put to you, how are the constraints on the US administration here? Are they sort of sailing between a rock and a hard place? And is it public opinion, J Street, AIPAC, and so on, who are all Congress, who are all influencing sort of decision making and exerting pressure? I would like, Ellen, would you like to go first?
Sure. So thank you, Ava. And we've started out with a genuine dilemma for the United States. You're certainly correct that, you know, the continuity of American support for Israel, whether it has a change of government, that there is still a very deep basis of both shared values and shared interests, a perception that Israel is a positive security asset for American interests, but also entitled to its democratic culture, etc. But certainly that vision of Israel is challenged from time to time. It's not the first time that the U.S. has had to sort of publicly say to Israel, you know, we support you, but, you know, please modify your behavior in some way. When President Bush 41, the elder Bush, had a showdown with the Israelis and Congress over the money that Israel was spending on settlements, contrary to U.S. law. Yeah. So there was a brief moment, yeah. I believe it lasted two yeah. years, where the United States restricted and even suspended some part of our assistance to Israel because we had a very deep disagreement over spending on Israeli settlements. Over time, we clearly lost that battle in the sense that Israel proceeded with settlement construction in ways that impeded the shared objective or the international objective of, you know, restoring the rights of the Palestinians through some form of political independence. So, you know, we're facing a terrible dilemma now. President Biden, I believe, was operating both from his heart and his head after October 7th, when he felt a very strong sense of, you know, moral imperative to support Israel after the horrendous and really grotesque attack by Hamas against innocent Israeli civilians. You know, was Hamas, you know, they also attacked Israeli military targets, but the damage done to Israeli civilians was extreme. But clearly over the weeks, the US administration has first privately and then publicly said to the Israelis, you know, we're really uncomfortable with the tactics you're using, this absolute bombardment of Gaza, the collateral damage. You say you are, you know, being careful about civilians, but the collateral damage is so extreme that, so the U.S. administration, including the National Security Advisor, flying again to Israel to try to set some, change the expectations on how Israel should proceed with its military campaign, is clearly underway. Domestically, you've mentioned, you know, who's pressuring the administration in what direction. I think that within Democratic Party circles, there's clearly a human rights component of people being uncomfortable with the administration giving Israel a green light for a military campaign that seems to be open-ended right now. The latest is the Israelis have said they need a few more, you know, maybe the end of the year, maybe a few more months. The U.S. obviously just vetoed at the U.N. A call for a ceasefire. But we really do have friction now in, you know, domestically, in part because American society is quite agitated about this, with both Jewish Americans and Muslim Americans feeling that the conflict has entered our, you know, domestic sense of peace and security, particularly on college campuses. So I do think the Biden administration runs the risk of looking weak, of looking like it doesn't have as much leverage over Israel as people expect it to have. The working with the Arab countries has also been a very important piece of this. I thought it was interesting that Jake Sullivan went to Saudi Arabia as well as to Israel. Maybe we'll talk about the Abraham Accords later, but I acknowledge what you're saying, that this war is both a foreign policy challenge for the Biden administration, and it does seem to be having some domestic repercussions. Of the two wars, Ukraine and Gaza, the Republicans seem to be more, the Republicans so far are supporting our embrace of Israel's need to defend itself, but they are challenging President Biden on his Ukraine policy. So maybe we'll want to differentiate between those two.
Thank you very much. Henri, would you like to comment also?
Look, there's not much to add to what Ellen said, but I would just try to emphasize something else. And that is that it is kind of very surprising to me that in the war against Hamas, that the Israelis don't really have any political objectives. I mean, wars are political events. You have to have political objectives. And the Israelis have not really, other than saying, we want to destroy Hamas, which clearly that is in of itself is not a real political objective because you don't they haven't defined what they mean by destroying Hamas. So I suspect that there's something else going on here. And this is why it is very important to understand the motivation of the Israelis, and because that may also be the answer to finding some kind of a solution for a ceasefire. I think the Israelis are very worried about the hostages. I think Hamas may not have all the hostages. And the hostage issue somehow has dropped off the radar screen and they're not being talked about as much. Although Biden met with the families of some of the hostages. But I would say there is something else about the hostages. Look, the Israeli military, I'm sure, is not happy with this policy that Netanyahu is pushing. But why haven't they objected more forcefully is, to me, the interesting question. And the only hypothesis I have, and this is only a hypothesis, is that there are a number of military hostages that they are very, very worried about, that what Hamas may do to them or what Hamas may do with them. And I heard that some of the concerns in Israel may have to do with the fact that these maybe some senior officers maybe actually be kind of smuggled out to Iran or somewhere else. And that is what is maybe driving the Israeli military to with this ferocious attack on Gaza, because they want either to prevent this from happening or try to show Hamas that Hamas will pay a huge price if anything were to happen to the hostages. And that may be also the way to deal to get to a ceasefire. I mean, if you can have a deal on hostages, I think the Israelis will go for the ceasefire almost immediately. But we don't know. I mean, I put this because Ellen basically said everything that could be said about this issue. I just wanted to add another perspective to try to explain this, because at the end of the day, everybody wants a ceasefire, and how do we get there is the issue.
Yeah. I find it very interesting what you said about the lack of sort of a perspective on a sustainable solution. We had not so long ago a talk in Vienna by Margaret Macmillan, the British historian, who has just published a book about war recently. And she spoke about war and she said three things. She said nobody who starts a war thinks about how he's going to end it. When you are in the war develops its own dynamic and in many cases escapes sort of political steerage. And you cannot influence events in a certain direction. And the third thing that she said is nobody who starts a war thinks that he might lose it. Yeah. And these are... it's also something that is very much in discussion in Europe here, that we don't see What can be the political solution, the political end to this confrontation? And that has, of course, that weighs on public opinion.
What we're hearing, I've now been to two Arab countries, one of which was Morocco is an Abraham Accord country, and Qatar is not, but Qatar has been deeply involved in obviously working with both Israel, Egypt, the US on these on what had been a very brief but successful initiative to release the hostages. And so certainly in the Arab world, the perception is that Israel cannot totally, to go back to Henri's point, you know, total defeat of Hamas is not attainable. You can demilitarize Hamas. You cannot take away the political and social movement part of Hamas. That is part of the spectrum of political life in a Palestinian politics. But some people are saying that, remember that if we do try to launch new diplomacy for a two-state solution, and many Palestinians and nearby Arabs say they are willing to jump on board that effort in due course when the fighting stops, that you have to remember that the Palestinian Authority as a structure is weak, but the government is still the PLO, the umbrella organization, and that Hamas would be part of a revitalization of Palestinian governance, and that Palestinians have to make choices. They would have to be given a chance to vote in some fashion at some point. And we don't know whether, you know, right now, would Hamas be the dominant political choice of Palestinians? I think as the suffering goes on, some Palestinians, and this is reporting from organizations that still have a presence in Gaza, Palestinians may have, you know, sort of felt exhilarated immediately after the horrible events of October 7th, but now they see Hamas as not caring enough about their well-being. And it is possible that Palestinian sentiment would turn against Hamas because they would be seen as having brought this terrible destruction upon them. So if we try to be optimistic and we see American former diplomats and UN officials trying to generate some smart thinking about how do we get back on a more constructive process, the Israelis should have no illusions that, you know, Hamas would still be part of the political landscape of Palestine. And there would be some level of uncertainty what Palestinian voters' preferences would be if they were given a chance. So that all suggests that, you know, I think Israeli, certainly the current Israeli government, and even if Israel had a more moderate government, there will be great, there's a great risk to them to move in that direction. They don't want to be legitimizing Hamas as a legitimate political actor. But if there were movement towards that two-state solution that has been the perceived consensus or compromise solution, the Israelis would have to somehow accommodate themselves to that. Back to Henri's point about whether the Israeli the professional military, do they? My sense is that right now, for perhaps because Israeli society is still quite traumatized, we're not seeing any splits yet in the Israeli national security establishment about whether this campaign is the smart way to go or not. Certainly, other Arab states perceive that Israel almost fell into Hamas's trap, that Israel's extremely strong reaction is what Hamas wanted. And so that Hamas was willing to pay that short-term price, thinking that there would be long-term political benefit. I just want to end with one point. The Jordanian foreign minister has now said that he believes Israel has already suffered a strategic defeat, whether they know it or not. So that's an ominous thought as well.
Yeah. But this corresponds also with everything that we hear here in Europe. When one hears that So Hamas has gained more support in the West Bank, where the support for Hamas was originally very weak, but with actions by the settlers against Palestinian villages and so forth, and as a consequence also of the war, Hamas has gained territory there. At the same time, I think one has to be careful. This is something that we perhaps don't hear enough about, that Hamas is not a monolithic thing. We speak about Hamas as if it were sort of one cohesive entity, but there are so many different organizations that are also operative in Gaza and are also involved, for instance, in the hostage situation, the Islamic State, ISIS, and so forth. And the Hamas also is a military terrorist movement, certainly. It is also an elected government, and to a certain extent, also an ideology. And all these components somehow have to be taken into account. Mm-hmm. I found it very interesting what you said about the work of the international organizations. We had not so long ago a long talk here in the Kreisky Forum with the Secretary General of UNRWA about the work that UNRWA is doing. And it's not only UNRWA, there are other UN organizations that are also active in Gaza, and especially World Health Organization and others. The rejection by Israel, of course, of the work that they are doing is doing a lot of harm to the international organizations also, and to multilateral diplomacy per se.
The UN folks that were at the Doha meeting just over the weekend were quite insistent that some of the reporting is a bit misleading of whether the UN agencies withdrew their international staff. And apparently that was true for the political mission, the determination it was no longer safe for them in Gaza City. But most of the specialized agencies, UNICEF, UNRWA, the folks who run, you know, contribute to the health services, education system, food supply, special programs for children. First of all, they're a mix of locally hired people that are Palestinian and international staff. And they were quite insistent that they are still on the ground. They are completely overwhelmed and stressed over the lack of sufficient resources and not enough trucks coming through with supplies. But it sounded to me like they are still quite deeply committed to continuing their work, even under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. So, you know, the Hamas is on the one hand, a kind of strongman government, an authoritarian style government, but it has understood that the UN is providing absolutely essential services and has been for many years.
Do you think that the Abraham Accords will survive this present crisis?
I wanted to say something else in response to some of your points you made, Eva. Look, it may seem like the Hamas is getting more support in the West Bank under the current circumstances, but we also have to not take every, shall we say, quick poll or every quick analysis at the moment as a truth. There are going to be major, major changes once this war is over. And in some ways, I wish some of these had happened even before the war started. Number one, there will be a new Israeli political system. This government, everybody knows, is going to collapse, and something else is going to replace it. There's going to be an investigation. They're not going to come out well. They're going to be really humiliated in many respects. So whatever comes out is going to be very different. So that gives once you have a new Israeli government that is composed not of Netanyahu and his colleagues, then we will have a different, shall we say, situation on the ground, both in Gaza, in Palestine, and in Israel, which will move things in a different way. Secondly, look, the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, have not lived under a democracy. I mean, Hamas is, by any stretch of the imagination, they won elections in 2007, and that's the last time they did anything. Right? So let's not say that they came to power democratically. There is no question that at the moment, when you're under the kind of pressure that the Palestinians are, any country always rallies around the flag, and they're going to rally around the current flag, which is Hamas. But once this is over, and I hope it's over soon, the Palestinians will have to ask questions. Why did this happen to us? Somebody has to answer, just like the Israelis have to answer, the Israeli government has to answer for what happened on October 7th. The Palestinians will have to go. And in many ways, this is awful to say, but I think new political systems will emerge, new leaders will emerge, on both sides of this divide. And that actually may be a hopeful sign for, I mean, to the extent that I want to be optimistic. The other problem with Hamas is also what you said, Eva, that yes, Hamas seemed to have complete control of Gaza, but it didn't, because you had these other organizations, the Islamic Jihad and other organizations, that have taken the hostages. And part of the reason why the hostage negotiations did not succeed is because I don't think Hamas could deliver on these. That means that Hamas, yes, was in control of Gaza, but was not really in control of Gaza, and allowed all these other organizations to emerge. So in some ways, Hamas really doesn't deserve to be the government and in many ways, the fact that you have all these other organizations complicates the hostage problem, and this is why we have fighting going on. If the hostage crisis had ended, there would not have been more fighting, in my view. On to Ellen about the Abrams Accord. She knows more about that than I do.
So, Eva, I think there's a great...
About the Abraham Accords?
Sure. So I think there's a weird paradox right now, which is everybody has just jumped to this conclusion that either they're dead or they are on, you know, life support indefinitely, because views of Israel have changed as a result of Israeli conduct during this war. But strangely enough, I think we're also getting signals from both the Saudis and the Emiratis that... they don't want to cut off entirely that process. For the Saudis, let's remember, it was a triangular, it was kind of hard to wrap your head around, but it was a three-way negotiation, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the US. And the Saudis have a wish list vis-a-vis the United States that would be part of a deal that would lead to their normalization with Israel. So they are not ready to say that that's over completely. Now, it's obviously on a long pause until circumstances improve. But so I don't think we should assume that the Abraham Accords were just a short moment in history and are now over. I think that some version of Gulf-Israel security relations will resume. Remember, for the Emirates, Hamas is also a terrible threat. I mean, their perception is that Hamas is a very, very dangerous organization for, you know, the moderate Arab societies. So they have very little sympathy for Hamas. And therefore, they, I believe, see their partnership with Israel as serving a counter-extremism, counter-terrorism purpose. So for the Saudis, it's a slightly different set of issues. They have to show leadership on the Palestinian question. I think they don't have the luxury, based on their history and their pretensions, if you will, to being the natural leader of the Islamic world, based on the custodianship of the holy shrines and mosques. I think they have to now step up to the plate on being more of a champion of Palestinian rights than they have been, even though we know that this younger generation led by Mohammed bin Salman are less, you know, less deeply attached to the Palestinian cause. I think that now that is politically imperative for them to show some leadership there. So it looks like certainly a tactical disruption of that process. But I'm quite struck by the quiet messages we're getting that there is not the intention to completely turn away from that, that eventually they want to do both. They want to help the Palestinians and they want to continue on some kind of path. Now, Arabs do resent that the Israelis haven't embraced and the United States government hasn't embraced more Arab versions of how would you get from today to what the Arab peace plan that would lead to both recognition and recognition of a Palestinian state. So there's a lot of work to be done, but I don't think we should assume that that whole initiative that began in the Trump administration has completely fallen apart.
Yeah, I completely agree with that analysis. It corresponds also to everything that we hear here. And it is something which perhaps is occasionally ignored when one talks about the conflict, that this is also a conflict with enormous regional implications.
Yes.
And that there is a whole region around it that has its own interests, and that are security interests, political interests, and that should not be, must not be ignored. Yeah, that's the reason why I asked about the Abraham Accords, because I would also think that this is a process that has been started where there is a lot of interest in the wider region to continue with on this track. May I ask a slightly different question? From your perspective, do you see any repercussions on the transatlantic relationship? I mean, in Europe, the situation is a little bit difficult because we have not managed really to hold the European Union as such together, yeah? As you saw in the vote in the General Assembly now, Austria voted completely, Austria, the Czech Republic voted completely different than France, for instance, and so it's a difficult situation because every country has its own relationship, and not only relationship with Israel and with the Palestinians, but also a different historical burden to carry. Going together with the United States is very important to us. Will we be able to maintain it? How do you see that?
There is actually an opportunity for a transatlantic cooperation. In many ways, I think the lack of a solution so far. There are many reasons why we didn't see a solution so far, but it seems to me that if there was a joint, very powerful American-European proposal on the table, putting pressure on all sides, when I say all sides, as you said, it's a regional conflict. So I mean not just Israel and Hamas, but Israel and Hamas, the Palestinians, and the rest of the Arab world kind of have an enormous, a really major, major push where the Americans and Europeans agree on the basic, shall we say, structure of a deal that could go quite far. And it hasn't happened so far, as far as I can tell. It's difficult, obviously, and it takes time to come up with a deal such as this one. But maybe they're working on it, and I wish they are, but I think rather than look at discord between Europe and the United States, I think this should be an opportunity for two sides to work together in a constructive way, because I don't really see any other solution out here. I mean, we are going to have to have a outside intervention of some sort to stop this.
Yeah. What we see here is that Europe, and this is perhaps something which is not easy for us to accept, but Europe has no real influence on this conflict anymore.
I don't buy that. I really don't buy that. I mean, Europe does have a great deal of influence by virtue of the aid it has given to the Palestinians over the years. Its relationship with Israel, the interaction between the Arab world. I mean, no, it has. It's a question of maybe it hasn't figured out how to articulate that interest, that influence, realize that influence. But that's maybe with the United States. Maybe alone it's hard, obviously, because the United States is such a big player here, right? But the United States and Europe together would have more than these, it would be more than the sum of its parts.
That's exactly what I just wanted to say, that if Europe wants to exert some influence, it has to go together with the United States. Europe alone will not be able to do anything.
I agree.
We have always given a lot of financial support, and this is going to continue. There will be also a demand, enormous demand for resources the moment the war is over and rebuilding starts and so on. But I think we have to be very careful about a serious consolidated approach between United States and Europe, especially in the aftermath of the crisis.
Ava, I wanted to make a point on the topic from a slightly different angle, which is that, just while the United States, political elites are wallowing in their unhappiness about the decline of American competence and power, et cetera, the outbreak of this crisis it reminded us that the United States still has unique diplomatic agility, because we're really better at crisis management and at crisis response than the large European collective. But for the issues that work out over a longer, slower process, the European Union is still, in some ways has a different skill set than the United States. I mean, I think of the European Union leading the JCPOA process, which the United States could not have done ourselves, on the nuclear agreement with Iran. That was a European-led process because it was a little bit deliberate and took time to cajole all the parties, and Europe eventually got the United States from being an observer to actually joining the table and rolling up our sleeves and participating in the drafting. So there's a complementarity to America's diplomatic skill set and Europe's skill set. But I quite agree with your point that should there be an international initiative to get back on track for a two-state solution, Europe and the United States, I assume, will be very close partners. But it does raise the uncomfortable question of whether China and Russia need to also participate. The West alone cannot be the only player. You're going to have key Arab states given a lot of responsibility. And then there is this question of whether the Security Council and, if it was a question of approving peacekeepers for Gaza, what do we do about the sort of East-West split that is emerging between, the West still generally aligned to a liberal world order and the big Asian powers really wanting to block that approach.
Yeah. Completely right. Whatever the political solution will be, it will need very strong and very effective international security guarantees for Israel as well as for the Palestinians. And this is will Russia and China then come into play also as parties to the possible solution? Talking about sort of the way out, what do you see as a political solution to the situation? I mean, we uphold the two-state solution. That's the legitimate international legal basis for the Palestinian demands, in a way. But one also has to be realistic. We have to see the situation in the West Bank. You see the settlements, you see the settler activities, and so it's not getting any easier. And there's also sort of, it implies the question, what kind of leadership on the Palestinian side is going to emerge? Because Fatah is discredited to a certain extent, and Hamas will be annihilated.
I think the outcome of the October 7th attack and the consequences is that for the Israelis, it will probably make it will make them realize that the two-state solution is the only solution. Don't look at, again, we are looking at the immediate, the anger, the war, but once the war is over, once an accounting is done in Israel, my sense is that the Israelis will realize that, look, they are living with the Palestinians next door. The Palestinians are not going anywhere. Yes, Hamas is an awful organization, but other Hamases can emerge as well if this situation is not resolved. Do you want to live with this for the rest of your existence? I think these guys will probably come with, and again, remember, there will be a new government, a new political system emerge. This is what happened after 1973 when the Yom Kippur War ended. There was a major commission, the Agonat Commission, and essentially undermined for a very long time the Labour Party for its mistakes in the war. Now, so the same thing is going to happen here, but it takes time. But I think that the two-state solution is now what will be. And when you talk to a number of people, when you look at the settlements, yes, they're a problem, but not some of the settlements were constructed by people who did it for economic reasons, not for political reasons. And so those can be either, you can do land swaps or you can convince them to move out. It's the political settlements that are a problem. But if the political movement that supported them is discredited in Israel because of the war, right, they will lose a great deal of support and they will have a choice. You want to stay there? Fine. The bigger problem, I mean, and that to be solved would be Jerusalem. I mean, Jerusalem is really the crux of the matter. It is not the settlements. Yeah. The settlements can be dealt with. It's how do we deal with Jerusalem? And there you have to have some very imaginative thinking. I don't have it. And that's where the hard work will come. But I think new leadership in Palestine, new leadership in Israel, will probably bring people who are more willing to compromise than before. One, two, in terms of new leadership in Palestine, I think there's this guy Gershon Baskin. I don't know if you know him. He has been pushing some very interesting ideas, including the release of Barghouti from Israeli jail, who has kind of emerged as somebody with an enormous following among Palestinians and kind of a natural leader. I mean, so you need somebody to replace the aging PLO leadership, etc. And finally, I would say that, look, we are very close to recognizing, I mean, look how many countries recognize the Palestinians as the representative of the Palestinians. So in effect, there is recognition. I mean, maybe Israel doesn't do it, but Israel deals with them. So we are this close to recognizing juridically the existence of a two-state solution. And I think we're almost there. The war has to end first.
Let me just raise the hard alternative, which is that spoilers in both Israel and in the Palestinian camp play with this idea of the one state solution. And they either, depending on where you live, believe that it could remain Israel as the dominant player and Palestinians given their rights, or from the Palestinian point of view, that you would, you know, turn the clock back to pre-1948 and Jews could live as a minority in a democratic state, a democratic secular state in which there are diverse communities. And, you know, this little playing with the idea of the one state solution has been around for a long time. Unfortunately, I think that some ideologues in both communities are going to, you know, use it as an alternative. You know, they will block consensus on trying to get to the two state solution. And I would not minimize the problem of dismantling settlement. You know, Israel did do the hard work of imposing resettlement on the Jewish settlers that had lived in Gaza, and they were forcibly taken out. There was some violence. The Israeli police had to come and, you know, arrest people, but they got them out. I think it's much harder in the West Bank. I think there's different historical attachment to sites there, to, you know, to the narrative, et cetera. But just let me just one last point. I think the Palestinians under the current conditions are revisiting the trauma of the partition plan, and in ways that I guess some of us who were far away from it may not completely appreciate. They've kind of taken back the perception that the partition plan, which did enjoy international consensus, was absolutely unacceptable to Palestinians and some of their Arab neighbors. So while we're saying very comfortably that from a Western international consensus diplomatic perspective, isn't the two-state solution the only game in town, people turn the clock back and say, we never bought into it. We never, you know, we have Resolution 242, we have the Arab peace plans, we have lots of more recent documents suggesting that Arabs would live with the two-state solution. But in the trauma of today, people are going back to the Nakba and 47, 48, and they're saying it never ended. So for them, their rejection in 47, 48 is still viable, is still the correct position. So I think these are pretty strong headwinds against moving easily back to the two-state solution.
Yeah, but still as far as I see it, the only feasible way to proceed. Yeah. I mean, the one state solution has a plethora of other problems.
For sure.
The ones that you have yeah. mentioned, but I mean, it goes to the core, really. That goes to the core of the idea of a Jewish state. And so it's... I think there are so many problems attached to it that I don't see that as a feasible option. Even in spite of Nakba and the attachment that people still feel to that Palestinians' traumatic event in their history, I still think the partition resolution and the two-state solution is the only legal base from which one can proceed at the moment.
Yeah.
The only thing I was going to add is I think the one-state advocates in Israel are such a small minority. It's not that they don't provide, I mean, on the Palestinian side, it's much more important. I mean, for the reasons that Ellen mentioned and maybe is being revived.
Yeah.
But on the Israeli side, I mean, we're talking about a very, very small minority that exists in every society.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that conversation. I enjoyed it. I think we have a lot of work to do, and we have to sort of pool all our creativity and all our determination in order to come out of that horrible situation that we are in at the moment. The repercussions are very, in my opinion, very strong. And you feel it also in the social situation in the European countries where all things are at the moment surfacing that we had thought are sort of gone for good, but they are still there and they are coming. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for your thoughts. Thank you for your insights. All the many good wishes.
Thank you.
We hope we will have another opportunity to talk soon.
Thank you, Eva. And happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you too. And all the best for the new year.